Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, working to assure opportunities for successful employment for all people with disabilities. A skilled workforce for Florida's businesses. The Able Trust. Empowerment, education, employment. On the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
After a rash of child deaths in Florida, child advocates say it's time to get mad and to get as many people involved as possible.
I'm here to represent the outrage, because that's the only way things get changed in our society. I'd love to get a Dream Defenders group to represent these children that have died.
Also this week, federal health care reform prompts concern in Florida about navigators and patient privacy.
We would need proof of citizenship or identity. We would need current pay stubs for the last 4 weeks and or their most recent income tax return.
We'll also get the latest on how the state agency that helps people with disabilities is handling a huge case backlog and how another agency is trying to keep nonviolent drug offenders out of prison. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Since April 20th, children who had already been on the Department of Children and Families radar died from child abuse or neglect. It's a number state officials say must shrink. And as Regan McCarthy reports, even though it's months before the start of the next legislative session in Florida, lawmakers are already working with experts and community leaders to find solutions.
Some of the children who died drowned, suffocated, or were brutally beaten. Pat McCabe, a foster parent and guardian ad litem, says it's time to get angry.
Unfortunately, the people that would be outraged in anger are dead, and their families that were part of the problem are negligent in their duties, or those kids wouldn't have been in those situations. So I'm here to represent Relia Wilson's ghost and say, you guys need to get some anger and outrage in you to change the existing conditions.
McCabe spoke during a town hall meeting Tuesday evening on what changes should be made to the state's child protection system. He says he got involved in the issue after then 4-year-old Relia Wilson disappeared from her home back in 2000. Hollywood Democratic Senator Eleanor Sobel called the meeting.
We're all outraged, but we're trying to keep calm about it, and we're going to try to do what we can. These are complex issues.
More than a dozen lawmakers, along with community leaders and officials from the justice system and DCF, attended the meeting where the group discussed everything from needing more transparency in the department to searching for more funding. And Alan Abramowitz, the executive director of the Florida Guardian Ad Litem program, says if the state does find funding to devote to the issue, he's got an idea for where it needs to go, toward getting the department's caseworkers on a career track.
We need our investigators to stay. The longer they're there, the safer children will be, because they have that experience.
Although Abramowitz does admit that no matter what the state does, it's probably not possible to completely zero out child death.
As long as there's someone out there that has the ability to harm a child, children will be harmed.
Abramowitz says some of that can be reduced through education. He says a practice as simple as co-sleeping could lead to a child's death if a sleeping mother were to roll over on and suffocate her small child. Family law lawyer and Stetson University College of Law professor Kate Bull agrees education is a good start, but she says it needs to go beyond parenting. If that happens, she says there could be a way to stop child deaths from abuse or neglect.
I think there probably is, and I think it involves a number of factors. It involves no unwanted children. That's a big deal. So women have to control their reproduction. It involves those wanted children being raised with sufficient resources, both them and their parents.
Bull says those resources would include good schools and good after-school or child care programs. Meanwhile, Interim Department of Children and Families Chief Esther Jacobo says her department is compiling a report on every child with department priors who's died this year of verified abuse. Once that's completed, DCF will ask Casey Family Programs to review what went wrong. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy in Tallahassee.
Even after its passage in Congress and success at the U.S. Supreme Court, wrangling continues over the Federal Affordable Care Act. Critics charge the devil is now in the details of the act's implementation. We have team coverage of two areas of current contention in Florida. The first is a report about what are called navigators from Tampa member station WUSF's Lottie Watts. Then we'll hear about patient privacy concerns from Florida Public Radio's Ryan Bank.
When the new online health insurance marketplaces open October 1st, millions of people will be able to go online and buy insurance at the click of a mouse. The federal government has a website, healthcare.gov, and a hotline people can call if they have questions. They'll also have people who can help face-to-face. They're called navigators. U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius.
These are individuals who will really be connecting people to coverage and having that ability to do outreach to many people who really haven't ever had coverage before and answer questions and get folks information so they can in turn make good decisions for themselves and their families is really an important piece of this puzzle.
In Florida, several nonprofit organizations are getting $7.8 million in grants to pay for navigators. Sebelius also says there's funding for other outreach efforts.
So this is a, I would say, a multi-part effort where it won't just be up to groups that receive the Navigator grants, but lots of networks. Every community health center now has resources to hire individuals who will be at that community health center, a logical place to say to people, if you don't have coverage, here are some options available to you.
Jerry Skinner has worked at Tampa Family Health Centers as a financial counselor for the last 5 years. At the East Tampa location, she sees uninsured people
every day, all day. Every single day, I come in and then we help them. You know, we do it as a courtesy to our patients, help them, you know, find insurance.
Floridians who can't afford insurance or aren't offered it through their employer have limited choices for coverage. Some of the patients Skinner meets can get health care through Medicaid or the Hillsborough County Health Plan for low-income residents.
If they're over the income limit, that's when we place them on a sliding scale. And that's for all of our clinics. You know, for any patient that walks in the door that don't have insurance or whatever, we'll put them on a sliding scale based on their income.
Skinner recently found out she's going to get training to help people sign up for health insurance once the online marketplace opens.
And it ties into my job and what I do already. Because that's what I do, is submit applications and, you know, help all of our patients don't have no insurance. So this is something I definitely need to learn, especially all the stuff that's going to be offered to us now.
Skinner says the clinics provide care for patients who are able to pay on a sliding scale, but it's not the same as having a health insurance plan. She says that will change drastically come October 1st for many of her patients. That's when they'll be able to start shopping on the marketplace for comprehensive plans, ones that don't exclude people with pre-existing health conditions.
All of our patients can have options. They can have, you know, something else. They don't have to say, oh, we can only hear on the sliding scale. They can finally get an insurance card that they're able to use and go to referrals and see specialists. Because when you're on a sliding scale, you don't have the insurance to see a specialist. And a lot of specialists, they charge a lot of money for out of pocket. So I can't wait for this Obama thing to kick in, and I think it's going to be great. Because for a long time, it really was not too much that I could offer my patients that were on sliding scales over the income limit.
Skinner starts her special training on the new health insurance marketplace next week. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lottie Watts in Tampa.
From Florida Public Radio in Tallahassee, I'm Ryan Bank. Governor Scott and other members of the Florida Cabinet aren't sure giving personal information to insurance navigators, who are supposed to help people sign up for insurance on the new exchanges, is a safe bet. Scott this week even accused the federal government of using a person's sensitive information to populate a national database.
We cannot stop the president's plan to create a new federal database that compiles personal information on Floridians and all U.S. citizens who enter the federal health care exchanges.
And that wasn't the only privacy concern the governor raised. Scott alleges navigators will share information with federal agencies, wouldn't be properly vetted, and wouldn't have the necessary amount of training to deal with sensitive information. But not everyone shares the governor's apprehensions. Healthcare reform advocates are quick to point out that a navigator's access to confidential information only occurs when a person initially signs up for insurance through the exchanges. Once that information is entered and sent through the marketplace, navigators have no real way of finding it again. And Don Stewart, who heads Kid Care in Orange and Seminole County, says her organization has been signing children up for insurance using Social Security numbers since 1998.
If they don't have a Social Security number and there is a different type of number, we would need proof of citizenship or identity. We would need current pay stubs for the last 4 weeks and or their most recent income tax return. They're 1040 or they're W-2. So there's a lot that's the same.
There is one distinct difference, though. Kid Care navigators don't share information with federal agencies. The ACA navigators will, but only with those that are applicable. For instance, in order to see what insurance tax credits a person can qualify for, the IRS would need to verify a person's income and tax bracket. But there isn't any indication the information would make it to a database. As for training, healthcare reform advocate Karen Woodall says the mandatory 20 to 30 hours is more than some other social program facilitators get.
The training, at least as I'm aware of it, is more training than the folks who are currently participating in enrolling families in the Kid Care program are receiving.
The Florida legislature passed a law last session that further regulated navigators, including a fingerprinting and background check mandate for anyone who wants to be one. Still, some state officials worry the law isn't broad enough to cover other ACA workers. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Bank.
Join the conversation. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. Still to come on Capitol Report, the future of a state agency that assists more than 30,000 disabled Floridians may hinge on two lawsuits pending in the courts.
Quite frankly, if we've made a mistake, then it should be fixed. And that's the way the system works. And unfortunately, what's going on right now is we're having to delay some things.
Another lawsuit accuses Florida of keeping people in mental hospitals unnecessarily by underfunding community-based treatment services.
I think part of it really is a stigmatization that is related to persons with mental illness. And generally, our folks also have addiction disorders related to it.
And prison sentencing reforms targeted toward nonviolent drug offenders may become a reality next year. But some wonder what that will do to the state's war on prescription drugs. The Agency for Persons with Disabilities recently solidified its financial footing after nearly a decade of budget deficits that put agency officials under a legislative and gubernatorial microscope. But now the agency is facing two lawsuits challenging its budgeting process. And as Lynn Hatter reports, the outcome of those legal challenges has the potential to throw the agency's future and those of the more than 30,000 disabled Floridians it serves into doubt.
The Agency for Persons with Disabilities has struggled with a basic economic problem: too much demand and not enough supply. At one point, the agency's budget deficit topped $100 million. To control costs, APD cut the amount of money it paid providers to take care of more than 30,000 disabled, mostly adult Floridians.
What I told the attorneys for APD is, I guarantee you, you would not wipe a grown man's butt for $7.50 an hour.
That's Ken LaRoe, a Central Florida banker who's a party to at least two lawsuits against APD. Ken's 26-year-old son is disabled, lives in a group home, and requires round-the-clock care. A year ago, LaRoe's family was notified the agency was cutting the Medicaid funding used to pay for his son's care by about 20%. The reason? The agency had a new way of divvying up those Medicaid dollars, called the iBudget.
It's pretty easy to see what they're trying to pull. Somebody sat around a conference table and said, well, let's gut the funding, figure out how to do it, and do it. And the only way to do it is with shenanigans, because it was such a shoestring budget to start with.
One lawsuit against APD alleges the agency didn't provide proper notifications to families about why their payments were being reduced. LaRoe challenged his son's allocation, but he says the 10-day challenge period after notification isn't long enough. But it's the second lawsuit challenging the rules used to implement the budget that has APD officials really nervous.
In fact, it has so much of a margin of error that it's a bit like throwing darts at a wall of numbers.
Gigi Rolini is an attorney with the firm Holland & Knight and is representing four people who say the mathematical formula the agency is using to determine awards is wrong.
We're talking about a program that is probably here to stay in Florida, and allowing a broken system to continue for years to come can't be the answer.
There is no way that an algorithm or any kind of formula can be developed where 30,000 people can go through that formula and it be perfect. It's impossible.
That's APD Director Barbara Palmer. She's credited with getting the agency's financial house back in order. And she says APD has been transparent about its budgeting process. And she points to internal figures showing most people who receive budget cuts don't challenge them.
About 90% of the people did not challenge. How's that? 10% of the people did.
But Nancy Wright, the attorney for 10 people contesting the agency's notification process, says most people didn't know enough to challenge the cuts.
And there were a lot of people that thought that everyone was getting a reduction. They thought, they were told that the agency was in financial difficulty and that they had to cut their budget and that this was just something they had to deal with. And so they felt like they didn't have a way to fight it.
Palmer says no budgets were reduced while they were being challenged. And she questions the motives and the timing of the rule challenge lawsuit, which came after nearly 2 years of hearings on the iBudget and its governing rules.
This challenge was done the very last day that the rule was going to be finalized. And obviously, you know, there has to be, what is the reason for it? That's the question we would like somebody to answer for us. Why did they wait so long? Why did they wait till the last minute? Why didn't they do it when we could have corrected whatever it was that was problematic for them?
Palmer says she believes part of the impetus behind the lawsuits is a drive to privatize the Medicaid disability waiver process in Florida. Both groups backing the lawsuits against the agency deny that. This year, state lawmakers added $36 million to the agency's budget, enough to provide services for more than 700 people on a waiting list. But those like Ken LaRoe, who have been watching the agency struggle with funding for years, say that's still not good enough.
It's a hellhole. It's a social services hellhole. And I'm a lifelong Republican. This is a business issue. This is not a liberal touchy-feely giveaway thing. So somebody that's got a handicapped child and they can't work, they're not contributing to the tax base. They're not, you know, it's not business-friendly.
Florida ranks near the bottom of states when it comes to providing care for the disabled. And if APD loses the lawsuits, it could be required to reverse many of the payment cuts made in the past 2 years. That could push the agency back into the red. But if the plaintiffs prevail in their challenges, they may again be able to afford services that, for some, mean the difference between living independently or being institutionalized. But there are still 20,000 people on a waiting list who are getting no services at all. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
The state of Florida says it will ask a judge to throw out a lawsuit alleging Floridians with mental illness are kept isolated from society. As Jessica Palumbo reports, the disability rights advocacy group that filed the suit says the state needs to do more to get people out of mental hospitals.
The lawsuit can be summarized like this.
People who want to leave and are ready to leave and are capable of leaving the institutions are being basically forced to remain because there is no community-based care to serve them.
That's Florida Supportive Housing Coalition President Shannon Nasworth. Her nonprofit group's members provide affordable housing for people living with disabilities. She says a large percentage of clients have mental illnesses, and most providers have wait lists.
We have people all over the state who are in desperate need of an affordable place to live with some supports. They're either in the institutions, or frequently if they don't get into the institution, they're homeless. They're forced to live on the streets.
Jay Reeve is CEO of Tallahassee's Appalachie Center, a nonprofit community mental health provider serving seven Panhandle counties. Reeve agrees the backlog in the state's three mental hospitals is enormous.
For instance, recently we were informed by the state that there were no male beds available at Florida State Hospital for the foreseeable future.
He says when that happens, patients who need long-term treatment end up staying in the Appalachian Center's crisis stabilization unit, but that's only intended as a short-term solution.
And that puts pressure on our system to move people out more rapidly. It puts pressure on the emergency rooms, and it puts pressure on law enforcement, and it just kind of breaks the whole system down.
Both Nazareth's organization and Reeves could receive more money if the suit is successful, even though they're not party to it themselves. The lawsuit filed in federal court by nonprofit advocacy group Disability Rights Florida says about 250 people whose doctors say they're cleared for release from mental hospitals have nowhere else to go. The suit also claims other patients who should be served in their communities are being sent to hospitals. Advocates say these patients should have other options, including group homes and staying in their own homes, with the help of a program called Florida Assertive Community Treatment, or FACT.
So this up the hill here is our FACT program.
On the Appalachian Center campus, Reeve points to the FACT team headquarters.
Yeah, they're probably in there doing staffing right now, and by 10 o'clock, most of them are out on the road.
So they sort of go wherever the client needs them to go?
Wherever the client needs them to go.
But longtime mental health advocates say state money for community-based care is almost non-existent, even in the best economic times.
When there's money, we get no increases, and when there's a decrease, we lose money. So we've never really won this battle.
Karen Koch is vice president at the Florida Council for Community Mental Health, a statewide association of providers. This year, she lobbied the legislature for $100 million in funding for preventative, crisis response, and residential mental health care. But she says no new money for adult services was allocated this year, cementing Florida's rank as one of the worst states for per capita mental health care funding.
When they're in the institutions, it's easy for them to ignore some of these individuals and their lack of rights. I mean, basically, the rights are being taken away from them right now.
But she says the legislature's lack of funding community mental health services isn't because the State Department of Children and Families, which runs the mental health system, isn't trying. A budget request filed with the lawsuit shows the department itself had identified people seeking treatment outside mental hospitals and requested more funding for their release. Koch says the suit, like similar ones filed in Ohio and Georgia, is a way to make the legislature confront the issue. That way, she says,
families don't feel that they have to put their child or spouse away, that they can feel comfortable working with the community and keeping them at home.
The Department of Children and Families and the Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA, are named as defendants in the case. Spokespeople for both agencies say they have not yet been served with the suit. ACA spokeswoman Shalisha Coleman says the agency plans to file a motion to dismiss the case, but declined further comment. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Making sure released inmates don't come back to prison is a main goal for prison reform advocates, not only on the federal level, but the state level as well. Florida in recent years has tried and failed to implement a series of prison reforms, particularly aimed at drug offenders. But as Sasha Cordner reports, that won't deter those same advocates from bringing back those same reforms next year.
Florida has more than 102,000 inmates in its prisons, and about a third is expected to return to prison following their release. The state has searched for ways to save money by lowering its recidivism rate, in part by getting inmates the treatment needed to contribute to society. Similar prison reforms came up again this year, including an idea that U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder recently announced he wants to implement on a federal level.
I have mandated a modification of the Justice Department's charging policy so that certain low-level, nonviolent drug offenders who have no ties to large-scale organizations, gangs, or cartels will no longer be charged with offenses that impose draconian mandatory minimum sentences.
Holder says he wants to leave that discretion up to a judge following a careful review process. That's similar to a bill authored this past session by Plantation Democratic Representative Katie Edwards.
So my bill responded to some of these concerns with our skyrocketing cost of corrections and said, you know, let's recalibrate and look at some different ways that we can let that first-time nonviolent offender who's caught with just a few pills raise the weight threshold, divert that person to drug court, get them treatment, and let the person who's caught with, you know, 28 pills, let that individual then look at facing potentially 3 years in state jail.
But Edwards may find herself up against state prosecutors and law enforcement who remain opposed to her approach. Florida Sheriff's Association Executive Director Steve Casey says Edwards' bill could hurt the progress the state has made in recent years in the war against prescription drugs. And he adds prosecutors already have that discretion.
Not everybody who's arrested for prescription drug trafficking is actually prosecuted for that. So the state attorneys have the authority to review the case, determine whether this individual is a first-time offender, whether they're a nonviolent offender, whether anyone's been harmed in this particular circumstance, and determine, you know, what diversion may be appropriate.
Instead, Casey argues the Department of Corrections needs more money to help inmates serve out their sentences and enter long-term treatment programs. Barney Bishop and his group, the Florida Smart Justice Alliance, also wants to place an emphasis on reentry and rehabilitation programs for inmates, but his group's approach is a bit different. Bishop's group proposed creating a reentry facility and asking the Department of Corrections to create incentives so private providers will want to participate. The so-called Smart Justice proposal was later watered down to exclude that component, leaving the measure with two parts: ID cards issued to inmates upon their release to make it easier for them to reenter society, and encouragement for the DOC to establish more of what the state calls faith and character-based institutions. The bill later died in committee, and Bishop is in talks with a couple of lawmakers to try again next year, even though he still believes his original bill could save the state millions of dollars.
There's something there for the Republicans in fewer crime victims, and there's something there for the Democrats that talks about helping people to not become criminals again. So it's not a soft-on-crime approach, it's a tough-on-crime, but let's be smart on how we spend our money so that we get the best bang for the buck.
Bishop anticipates some resistance from Shalimar Republican Representative Matt Gaetz, who was not a fan of the bill last session and chairs the House Criminal Justice Subcommittee. Meanwhile, Edwards' bill may have a better chance next year. She says she's working with Gaetz, and her Senate sponsor is Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley, who chairs the Senate Budget Committee for Criminal and Civil Justice Issues. The bill forecasts $20 million in savings over the next 5 years. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Ryan Bank, Sasha Cordner, Lynn Hatter, Stan Jastrzebski, Regan McCarthy, and Jessica Palumbo. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And join us again next week for more reports from the State Capitol.
Audio copies of Capital Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capital Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, committed to helping high school students with disabilities graduate and advance to jobs, post-secondary education, and a bright future. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment, on the web at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.